Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks so much for tuning in. In Maryland and many other parts of the country, thousands of sick people languish on organ donation waiting lists, some for years. They are waiting for a donor to die and to do so in a way that preserves the organ they need. Demand far exceeds supply. But some organs, like kidneys and livers, can come from living donors. Later in the hour, we'll talk with a man who chose to donate one of his kidneys. And Johns Hopkins bioethicist Jeffrey Kahn will help us understand the many ethical questions posed by organ donation. But first, a new play by Michael Hollinger called Under the Skin, on stage at the Everyman Theater in Baltimore through February 21st, examines what it means to give away a body part. In it, a father asks his estranged daughter for a kidney. The request prompts some intense soul-searching. In this clip, we're going to hear the daughter, played by Megan Anderson, and then a mother, played by Alice Gatling, and her son, played by Keith Royal Smith.
This story is not about kidneys.
Sure it is.
No, it isn't.
It kind of is.
It's about another kind of organ. It's about the human heart, okay? The boundaries of the body and the limits of love.
Go on.
The place where I stop and you begin.
In other words?
It's about flesh and blood and about what we owe to those who share them. And what they owe us. That's what this story is about.
Well, that and kidneys.
Right, them too.
As you can pick up from that clip from Under the Sun, it's a comedy as well as a serious play up now at Everyman Theater, written by playwright Michael Hollinger. And Michael Hollinger joins us by phone from Philadelphia. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks so much. Great to talk with you.
It's great to talk to you, too. With me here in the studio is Jay Herzog, Everyman Theater's resident lighting designer. Thanks for being with us, Jay.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. I'm a huge fan of your show and of WYPR.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to know that. We're especially glad you're here because you have lived some of the issues in this play. Just about a year ago, you received a partial liver transplant from a living donor. So what is it like to work on a play about organ donation after going through that experience?
Well, let me start by anybody who's seen the play or is going to see the play that my relationship with my donor is very different than Lou and Raina in the play.
They have a prickly relationship.
They do have a prickly relationship. And my donor and I are two people who really care about each other very much. The play is, first of all, I think Michael has crafted an amazing play, which is very honest to what a relationship could be and what it is for not only for Raina to think about giving her estranged dad a kidney, but as well, I've done a lot of processing of it recently, and I haven't really talked to Michael about it, but Lou also, as a father, waits quite some time before his diagnosis and being able to face his family to ask. And I would like to think that he went through a lot of the process that I did, and that's how do you ask? How do you take something that you've brought into the world to love and to take care of and for you to nurture, and then all of a sudden have them or a person in your life or a friend or a relative, a husband or wife, how do you ask them for something like that? How do you...
It's a big ask.
It's a huge ask. It's very, very emotional. It was a very big play in our family. Everybody knew what their blood type was. Everybody knew what the possibilities were among our family. And then Facebook became a really interesting place for me to go to look for people. And it's pretty amazing how many people just came out of the woodwork to volunteer.
Volunteer to be a donor.
To be tested,
be a donor. Michael Hollinger, how did this subject intrigue you?
Well, Under the Skin started really as I stumbled over some articles that dealt with kidney transplantation in particular. And what I was struck by as I read more and more articles on the phenomenon was how complex family dynamics are and how much they are intensified through this process. And that could be intensified in a happy way as you know, Jay's circumstance in seeking a donor. But it also, within families in particular, where often emotions are fraught, it can intensify things in a negative way. So started to discover stories about donors between siblings, between parents and children working in both directions, and recognizing that those things were not simple at all. And what attracted me to the story initially was that it really sort of put a lens on issues of parents and children and siblings that are quite universal for everyone, whether they have organ issues or not, and that it really made those issues, brought those issues to the fore because the clock is ticking, because they have, there are grave consequences if you have divisions between members of a family. So really, I sort of entered this terrain kind of through the back door, but it, as with all of my plays, they take place in a very specific world with very specific information, but always seek to have larger resonances for everyone, because I think, you know, parents, children, siblings, we are human beings.
Given everything you just said, was it always clear to you that this play, you once you started to write it, was going to be a comedy?
Yeah, it was. It was clear to me. Obviously, it doesn't seek to make light of a rather grave situation for many people. But the particular article I first stumbled on was an ethical essay dealing with the question of two siblings, both of whom wanted to be the organ donor for their father, and wondering how they would solve this problem. And for me, as I started to contemplate sibling rivalry with a brother and a sister both wanting to be their father's donor, suddenly that seemed funny to me because siblings can be really, really funny with each other. And I, you know, so yeah, it did strike me right away as a comedy, and that often surprises people because, again, the stakes are high. The situation is grave for many. But, you know, life is full of those situations where there is gravity and levity as very close neighbors.
It's Michael Hollinger here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Hollinger has written a play about organ donation, now on stage at Baltimore's Everyman Theater. And in studio with me is Jay Herzog, a liver transplant recipient who designed the lighting for the production. Would you give an organ to a family member? What about a stranger? Or have you already done so? Join our conversation. You can call us. Our local number is 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Jay Herzog, tell us about the moment when you knew, when you were told you needed a liver transplant.
I was feeling pretty well. I was working in a summer camp with volunteering with kids in June of 2014. I was running on the beach with them. I had noticed some really odd weight gain over a period of time of probably
weight
about
gain.
Weight gain over about 6 months. And, you know, I've never been heavy before, and I really didn't know if it was anything other than I'm
We're getting too much.
Yeah, I'm getting a little older. I'm 56 years old, and this is what happens. When I woke up on Labor Day, I honestly couldn't, I could no longer, all of a sudden, I couldn't see my toes. My belly was so extended. I had such terrible ascites. And I was holding, I guess by the time they actually physically drained the liquid out of there, it was about 8 liters of liquid that I was carrying. But before I got the drain, I went to the local hospital, and they gave me an ultrasound. And the ultrasound technician kind of looked, and she said to me, which I don't really know if she was supposed to, it was just kind of a little slip, and she said, "Oh, I didn't know you were here for cirrhosis of the liver." And I said, "Oh, neither did I. That was quite a surprise. And she said, "Well, the doctor will speak to you afterwards." And the doctor came down about 20 minutes, 30 minutes after my testing. I was in the hospital for a few hours. And he just looked at me and he says, "You have end-stage liver disease, and they call it NASH. And NASH basically means that you have cirrhosis of the liver, and it's not related to alcohol." That's really what it means. And there's lots of ways that could come about. I had a disease called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, Obviously, both my parents were carriers. Neither of them knew anything about it.
And they did. They did not have liver problems in their their lives.
No, because you have to. Generally speaking, you have to have two Z chromosome issues.
I see.
In order to get it, so my mother obviously has one, and my dad had one. One of them could be my father. Could have had the disease, and it just never. Nothing ever happened from that. But he was deceased by that point, so we couldn't find out. But no, neither of them have had liver disease, and so I honestly. I just went into shock. I was alone in the hospital. I was very casual about it. I guess my wife was working or something. I can't remember exactly why she wasn't with me, but she wasn't with me at the time. And I had to go home and tell her. So it was a sudden thing. I mean, I actually found out within a few hours. I knew nothing about it before that. So I went to a GI, and the GI talked to me. And one of the things he said to me was, he says, you know, you will need a transplant. And he told me the story about the transplants, and he told me how long it might take to wait and what a MELD score is, which are, you know, blood tests that kind of indicate when you can get one. You have to reach a very high score. He said to me, if you're waiting for a deceased liver, it could be that you're going to wait 4 years because you have to be one of the sickest people with liver disease in the state of Maryland or within your region to get one. So he says, let's just call it that you're going to be about 30 days from death. When you can actually get a deceased donor. He said, there is an alternative. And I said, what? He said, there's an alternative. And he said, you could get a partial liver transplant, which I never heard of before. So what they did is they take 65, 60, 70%, the large lobe, because the liver is divided up into two lobes. You have a small lobe and a large lobe. And he says, they would take the large lobe out of another adult who's in excellent health. They would transplant into me, and within 6 weeks, both of us would have a full-size liver again. It would just regenerate. So I just took a big breath, and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about it. And it came down to, big decision for me was, what do people want to see? Do they want to see a Jay Herzog who is degenerative and everything's falling apart and he can't work anymore and he can't take care of the family anymore, you know, basically becoming disabled from it? Or do we take action and do we do a living transplant and get it while I'm healthy? Because the healthier you are going into a living transplant, such as a kidney or a liver, the better off you will be at the end because you're not as sick when you get it.
And I want to pick up, we'll definitely pick up your story later in the hour, but before we let Michael Hollinger go, let me ask, I mean, we just got a sense of how much education there is to be done when someone is facing an organ transplant. Your play focused on a kidney transplant, not liver, but did it change your own outlook toward organ donation, your play?
Oh, yeah, radically. And that's because I did interview a number of donors and recipients. One of the key ones was a transplant coordinator who when I set up a first meeting to talk with her just to gather information about what kind of medical tests someone would go through and various criteria, I didn't know that she herself had been a donor. And when I interviewed her, she told me her story where she encountered a listing in her parish's newsletter that said that a parishioner at her church needed a kidney. The person was not identified, and she looked over at her husband and said, I think I'm going to do that. And so I was sort of deeply impressed by her just open-hearted altruism with someone that she had never met before. And so those two things were working at once, I guess, in terms of research. One was the technical aspects that I was gathering information about and learning about, but really I think my heart was opened by the stories of people saying, this body part doesn't belong just to me. Why is the boundary of my body my skin? Maybe this could belong to someone else too. And that's I think really beyond the medical situation, what the play is seeking to explore, which is where do I end and where do you begin?
And your play is getting a terrific reaction in Baltimore. Lots of folks are talking about it. Michael Hollinger, I appreciate your joining us. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Under the Skin will be at Everyman Theater through February 21st. A link to more information about the play will be at WIPR.org on the midday page, including some information about a special discussion following this Sunday's matinee on February 14th. We have to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll speak with Johns Hopkins bioethicist Jeffrey Kahn and with a kidney donor. And we'll hear more from Jay Herzog about his experience as a liver transplant recipient. Has your life been changed by an organ donation? Join our conversation. Our local number is 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Today, we are talking about organ donation. And joining us now by phone is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, professor of bioethics and public policy at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very, very glad you could join us. Still with me in the studio is Jay Herzog, a liver transplant recipient. And we've been joined by David, a kidney donor. David has asked we not use his last name. I'm so glad you joined us, David. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
So tell us a bit about your story. You donated a kidney to a friend about a year ago.
Yeah, that was donation day was December 1st, 2014. I guess it's more our story than my story, but a friend of mine that I knew through professional circles who I'd become really good friends with over a period of years just sort of got really sick all of a sudden. And, you know, it was an educational process for, I think, everyone in the immediate circles around him about what was going on, and that he was in full kidney failure. And, you know, the story kind of goes, he had contracted whooping cough from one of our colleagues at work who had went to Kuala Lumpur, and you know, and a bunch of people got it, and then he never really resurfaced in the office. And it was a person that it just had never really missed any work, and so we became concerned, and I tracked down his wife, and they said he's in the hospital, and I went to see him in the hospital, and you know, they were putting a port in because they were preparing for a long-term dialysis. And I mean, this happened in the space of less than 2 weeks. And so that's kind of the beginning of the story. That was in, I believe, late 2011. And my recipient, Tom, being who he is very humble, very reticent to discuss himself, or, you know, he's sort of had this soft protocol of asking him questions and getting a little bit of answers. And through that long process, we sort of figured out he was on the donor list. What the, you know, the beginning of the living donor process looks like. And then my wife and I had a discussion that, you know, I wanted to at least try, you know, and at least be evaluated to see if I could, you know, help Tom. And, but I wanted to make sure that my wife and I were 100% on board before I asked for the phone number, because I knew that, you know, he was suffering. I was watching him die before my eyes over the course of that time span. And so, you know, I think probably any of these stories are a collection of people's stories. I think...
Let me ask,
sure.
I want to hear more of this, but I'm curious, Jay, as you're listening to this, Jay Herzog, and I'll, you know, I just want to remind listeners, this is not a pair. David donated a kidney, and Jay received a partial liver transplant. But you had just talked a few minutes ago, about your concern about what a donor would be thinking, what kind of stress it would be on a donor. What goes through your mind when you hear someone like David describe, not quickly in time, but sort of, it seems like relatively seamlessly coming to the sense, I want to see whether I can do this. I want to see whether I could be this donor.
First, I want to give him a big on-the-air hug. That's the first reaction that I have for him, because without people like him, my friends that I've learned to love through the process, who are all recipients, wouldn't be here today. At least, you know, through the deceased donor program or the living donor program, we really need to have donors. So I can't do anything but say thank you to him. I mean, if everybody loves somebody enough to take care of them in this world, we wouldn't be having as many issues as we have trying to get donors. It's a very, very fabulous thing that David has done. And I don't really know what else to say about that.
Okay. Let me ask Jeffrey Kahn, the waiting list to get an organ from a donor who has already died, a deceased donor in the United States, is divided into 11 geographical regions. Is the wait longer in some regions than in others?
So yes is the answer to that question. And you can be listed in different regions if you have the wherewithal and the means to fly to a different medical center. So you wait longer depending on where in the country you're waiting, and you could wait longer or less time if you can get yourself onto multiple waiting lists. So the case that most people may have heard of is Steve Jobs, the former CEO of Apple, who's no longer alive, but he had a kidney transplant in Memphis, Tennessee, although he lived in Northern California in the Bay Area. And that was possible because he had himself listed in multiple places, and he rose to the top of the list in multiple places, and the first organ that became available to him was in Tennessee, so he was able to be transplanted there. So there are many different variables that go into determining how long an individual might have to wait, and of course it depends on what kind of organ they're waiting for and how sick they are and where they live in the United States.
Jay Herzog, pick up your story for us. You were telling us essentially that you had looked at what your prospects were if you waited for an organ from a donor who already has died, and you were sort of starting to look at how could you be part of find a living donor.
Yeah, obviously I had the conversation with my family first, because that's the doctors and the system really want to make sure that the person who is your donor is the best connected person for you, not just physically but emotionally, and that there's a reason why they want to give is very important to that team of doctors, and especially to the social workers. The social workers spend a lot of time with the donors discussing why they want to do that. So I think that, I'm sorry, your question again, really? Sorry,
well, Sheila. I guess if you could just tell us briefly what happened when you decided to look for a living donor.
I decided to become very outgoing. I went immediately onto Facebook. I emailed I didn't actually target anybody specifically. I felt that that was not what I wanted to do. But I was very open about my illness, and I wanted people to learn through my illness. So every day I was posting what this was like to go through. I was almost blogging daily about it. And I had 12 people sign up to be tested. Out of those people, they pretty much eliminated 6 almost instantly just through their written evaluation. As soon as you're overweight by a certain amount, they're going to take you off that list. Mm-hmm. What is really important to the surgeons is that donor must be the healthiest person that you could possibly find, because they don't want to take a perfectly healthy person and make them sicker. They actually told me, they very clearly, which made me feel really confident, that if something happened that was horrible in the operating room to my donor, and it took all the doctors to save the donor's life, that they're going to let me go. That actually helped me make my decision.
I can imagine that it would. So, David, you are a living donor.
Yes, I am.
you started to describe to us making the decision, making sure your wife was okay with it. Other than that, did you have qualms about doing it?
You know, the more I found out about being a live donor, and I can only speak to being a live kidney donor, there's some pretty interesting statistics involved with the process. If you are successful in being vetted as a live kidney donor, statistically speaking, you will live longer than someone who does not donate And that is because they're very rigorous in who they select to go through with the whole process. And
a fine specimen.
Yes, exactly. It's like being shot into space, really. That's what I felt like. And so I don't know. I think I really waited in the sense that I think life is really short, just in general. And the longer I'm alive, the more apparent that is. And I think it's important to do something that matters with life, you know, for me personally. And I've tried to do that in a lot of different phases of my life. And this was just one of those things that felt like a very unique opportunity to be helpful to someone I cared a lot about. And I really believe in the living donor community anyway, the people that I have the most respect for are people who just donate, you know, or are kind of blind living donors, you know, and I've met a couple of them and they're particularly courageous. I mean, to like my recipient as much as I do and to watch them die in front of me, essentially. I mean, it was really, there were a number of people, just like in Jay's case, where people had lined up for this individual to at least be tested initially. But I didn't really have any, I don't know, maybe I'm kind of a knucklehead, but my wife is really the person who made the hardest decision, because I think for her, she had to weigh the, like, what if this doesn't work out? And for me, I'm like, this doesn't work out. I've done a good thing. You know, if whatever afterlife there is, I'm pretty sure I'm going to at least skip some of the line to get in there. And
so you felt like you were getting something.
Yeah.
There was something worth it to you.
Yeah.
Several things worth it to you. That is David here on Midday on WYPR. David is a kidney donor. Also with me in the studio is Jay Herzog, who is the recipient of a partial liver transplant just about a year ago. And we're on the line with us is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, a bioethicist with the Berman Institute at Johns Hopkins. We've got several callers. Christina is calling us from Hagerstown. Welcome to Midday, Christina.
Hi. Hello.
You're on the air.
Hi, it's a little hard to hear you, but I was extremely fortunate enough to be a kidney donor to a non-designated recipient. His name was Joe out of Mauganville, Maryland. John. I actually went to donate my kidney to a neighbor of ours. His name was Joe. And I went through the process, and one day we were going to go through the transplant, and his white blood cell count was low, so we couldn't actually have the transplant that day. So about a year after, several months later, I had gotten pregnant, so I was not able to donate to Joe. And then about a year after, he received a kidney and a pancreas from someone who had passed away, and I just thought it was completely amazing because I couldn't give Joe a pancreas. And about a year after that, Joe passed away. He got pneumonia and gotten really sick. And I was already in the process of being a donor because I promised him I would still give him my kidney if he needed another kidney. And after he passed away, I just decided that, you know, I'm still going to give my kidney away. It doesn't matter who it goes to. It's really for Joe. And after I ended up going through the process of being the donor, the day after surgery, John, the recipient, we were able to meet. And come to find out, John is, you know, another neighbor of mine, lives about a mile away from our house. And it's almost like an extended family. I have another brother now. I have a whole other family. And it was the absolute best decision I've ever made in my life.
Christina, I appreciate your call. Jeffrey Kahn, let me ask you, let me point this out. In Under the Skin, the play we were talking about earlier, Michael Hollinger's play about organ donation that's now up at Everyman Theater, the idea is raised briefly about buying a kidney, about maybe there could be some kind of money that would change hands. Why isn't compensating donors a good idea? I mean, I think a lot of us think, well, you know, it would certainly increase the pool of donors.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'll answer the simple way and then the more complicated way. And the simple answer is it's illegal under federal criminal law. So there's something called the National Organ Transplant Act, which was passed by Congress in 1984, which prohibits anything of value being exchanged in return for a solid organ. So that's the answer in policy. So why do we have such a policy? And that really is a story about an enterprising physician who was trying to create a market with the intent of doing what you just said, which was creating a larger pool of people being willing to give their kidneys to try to reduce the number of people waiting. Now, we have to talk differently about what that kind of relationship is. It's not a donation anymore, right? If you pay somebody for something, they're no longer a donor. They're a vendor, you've traded something in return for that kidney. And the concern from an ethics perspective is, one, depending on how you allocate those organs. So if you create something that would be like an eBay for kidneys, that creates an opportunity for those with the greatest means to have the greatest access. So there's an unfairness in that, a lack of equitable access. On the donation side, there's a concern about exploiting people, that everybody has a price, and the lower you set the price, the more the desperation of the people who would come forward and give for that price. And so there's long been a concern about compensation leading to exploitation. That said, there's never been a study of what the effect of offering compensation, a little or a lot, might be on the willingness of people to be donors. So one of the claims is if you inject money into the system, you would then exclude people who were altruists. They would not want to be part of a system where there was money exchanged. You've heard stories from Christina on the phone just now and then David, who are clearly altruists. That was their motivation. And we don't want to do anything but laud that, and they're heroic for being so altruistic. And so one of the concerns is injecting money or some kind of compensation into a system might actually push those kinds of people out, and so rather than increase the supply, may actually have a detrimental effect on the supply. So all of those things together are the basis for why we have persisted in policy over what's now approaching 30 years, or just over 30 years, a policy that prohibits anything of value being exchanged for solid organs.
It's Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, a bioethicist with the Berman Institute at Johns Hopkins. We need to take another break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the dilemmas posed by organ donation. Is it a waste to put a 25-year-old kidney in a 65-year-old person? Is it fair to make an older person wait for an older kidney? Plus, more from two people who have experienced organ donation firsthand. Join our conversation. Our phone number is 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I am Sheila Cast. We're talking about organ donation this hour and some of the dilemmas it raises. With us on the phone is Johns Hopkins bioethicist Jeffrey Kahn. And with me in the studio is liver transplant recipient Jay Herzog and David, who donated his kidney to a friend. You can be part of the conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Kat sent us an email. She writes, "I think it is so true that family and personal dynamics weigh so heavily for some people. I worked with a woman who really perplexed me because her twin sister needed a liver transplant, and she was really torn in her decision. I couldn't understand how this wasn't an immediate yes when it was her sister, and more so her twin. But I've learned that not all siblings share the close bond that I do with my sister and brother. She ultimately declined to be tested, and I'm not sure what happened with her sister because she refused to talk about it." And Kat thanked us for this program. She said, "When I talk about her experience, many people are not aware about living donor opportunities." David, what goes through your mind when you hear about a case like that?
You know, I think it's a very personal decision, and it's hard to know what factors would have gone into making someone uncomfortable with donating to their sister. I mean, for me, it's kind of a little hard to imagine, frankly. But you know, I can't pass judgment on those folks. And in my particular instance, it was pretty clear from the beginning that, you know, we were going to have to do something about it. And the we is kind of my family unit. But I think I've been surprised by the outpour of, you know, you're a hero, you've done this great thing. And I think for most living donors that I've talked to, it just seems like very logical. It's like, no, this is the thing that you do. It's like my friend, someone I know very well or care a lot about, is like locked in a car that's on fire. And all I have to do is go open the door. I have to be willing to go open the door. And it's that kind of thing. It wasn't, I didn't think about it in a mortality kind of way. It was more of a kind of a shorter decision span. So I really can't speak to what kind of factors would have influenced that sort of thinking, but I don't entirely understand it.
Jeffrey Kahn, I imagine something like being asked to donate a kidney for a family member might generate a lot of conflicting emotions, guilt, maybe resentment. Does the medical community concern itself with making sure people who decide to donate are doing it for the right reasons?
They do. And I think David spoke to that a little bit in his telling of his story about how he came to be a donor. So among the things that are of concern to the medical community, aside from the obvious physical health-related concerns, are motivation. And then within families, the concern is usually around pressure, which is a term I don't think we've heard mentioned. But people feel a lot of pressure to donate to someone in their family who, as David said, you know, all you have to do is open the car door of a burning car. But people feel a lot of pressure to come to the aid of those in their family. And not everybody's willing to do that for all sorts of complicated reasons. Sometimes people think, well, if I give to that person, then I won't have the option to give to someone who's more closely related to me, one of my children, say.
That comes up in the play Under the Skin, too, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that there's always an attempt to get as much clarification about motivation, either for doing or for not doing, going forward with a donation as the medical team can really figure out. And I think it was David who was talking about the social workers' involvement, and there are psychologists, sometimes psychiatrists, in addition to the medical team.
Well, part of what crosses my mind, even as I asked the question to you a minute ago, is who is to say what the right reason is?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking, for example, we seem to be talking here at this table a bit about how, well, guilt shouldn't be guilt tripped into this. But guilt is a very live, functioning force in many religions.
And very powerful within families, absolutely. But I think the idea is that it needs to be voluntary, right? So people shouldn't feel forced in a way that they feel like they cannot say no. And in fact, that's a question that's often asked within family donations in particular. Do you not want to do this but can't say that to your loved one? And then there's a discussion about whether that person, if they say, I just can't say no even though I don't want to do it, there's a discussion about whether they're medically eligible. So no one should be forced. It should be a voluntary decision. And you've heard from very heroic people who are willing to do that for someone that they don't have that very close family relationship with. But the converse of it, right, is when people do have family who need a donation, but the people who are in line to do it or are eligible to do it feel very conflicted. And there needs to be a way for those people not to feel like they're forced.
Let's talk to Kate, who is calling us from Towson. Kate, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I celebrated 5 years on Monday with my new kidney transplant, and I was part of a really special program, the Paired Exchange Program, which my father-in-law wanted to donate a kidney to me. He's in his 60s. I was in my 30s. We entered into this program. We found a mother-daughter out in California who were a very good match for us. The daughter was a great match for me. The mother was a great match for my father-in-law. So they came to Maryland and lived here at Hopkins for 6 weeks while we went through our transplant. The daughter gave the kidney to me. My father-in-law gave his kidney to the mother. And, you know, 5 years later, everyone's doing terrific. It was a really amazing experience. I'm incredibly close to my father-in-law. I'm incredibly close to my donor. I consider them both my donors. But it was a really amazing way for me to get a kidney that I needed through a different avenue.
I appreciate your telling us the story, Kate. Jeffrey Kahn, are there any particular ethical concerns about paired exchanges?
Sorry, did I cut you off?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't know that you were going to say something more. It's a very interesting means by which people who otherwise want to be a donor but don't match their intended recipient can make a donation, perform that donation, and have their loved one still receive a kidney in the case of these paired exchanges. In fact, it's interesting that Kate reports her story of having gone out and found the people who they could swap with. But now there's increasing attempts to find those people through the organ transplant system as a way of creating more opportunities for more people through not just two pairs exchanging, but effectively daisy chains of many people being willing to be donors, sometimes triggered or initiated by one person who's willing to be a non-directed donor, so willing to be a donor to anybody who might need a kidney. And adding that one kidney can sometimes trigger a domino effect of, I think the longest now is in the 40s, number of pairs who therefore are eligible, and you can get 40 transplants out of this kind of domino effect approach. The ethics concerns which have been addressed were about whether that kind of exchange constitutes something of value being offered in return for an organ. So back to my comment about NOTA earlier in the hour, and the general counsel of the relevant part of the federal government, so the lawyers there have ruled that does not violate NOTA, even though it seems like something of very great value is being received in exchange for the willingness to donate.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about what constitutes value in this situation, it's enormous.
Of course, but life changing, if not
beyond,
life saving, right?
Beyond measure, in a way. Osama is calling us from Baltimore. Osama, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the show. I wanted to know about some of the comments, or if I could get some comments from Jeffrey Kahn about how we could align self-interest with the altruistic act of donation, which is something that was proposed by a researcher, Rupert Jarvis, back in 1995, about reciprocal altruism, where in this system, where someone who has agreed to donate their organs posthumously would be higher in a transplant waiting list where if they do need an organ than someone who has not agreed to donate an organ. And I've done some preliminary research on this, and there is data to suggest that people would be more willing. It would be a modest increase. It won't increase organ supply a lot, but it would be a modest increase in organ donations by when people would know that they would be higher on the transplant waiting list. And the other thing that I wanted to ask was if the U.S. would be willing to adopt an opting out system like Spain to increase their organ donation rates. Yeah, thanks.
Osama, thank you for both of those questions. Jeffrey Kahn, did you hear them?
I did. Really interesting questions, and I'll maybe take them in the order that he asked them.
Minutes are ticking away.
Okay,
so
I'll be really quick. So there is a country in the world that has actually adopted the first suggestion, which is if you're willing to be a donor, then you have higher priority should you need a transplant, and that's Israel. And they did that as a way of getting more people being willing to be deceased donors. So there is a kind of experiment happening, and we'll see whether that actually bears fruit. The second question is, and unfortunately an easier one to answer, which is in the United States, we really are not a country that believes in forced taking of things from people. So in other words, we allow people to opt in to be an organ donor after they die. The opt-out model would be we assume you're willing to have have the country take your organs unless you tell us otherwise. And that just doesn't seem to square with the values of this society. Now, maybe that will change over time, but it's been proven over and over in all sorts of public surveys and discussions that just is not a policy that the American public's willing to undertake.
Jay, you were nodding your head vigorously at the suggestion of benefits for donors. Do you think Do you have in mind what a benefit would be that would comport with the legal requirements?
Well, I always felt that, you know, if somebody like Dave, as an example, gives away a kidney and their child needs a kidney, I would like them personally, this is just my personal thought, to be able to move closer to the top of the list. I think that that's something that they have earned to do. Whether or not you put a heart on your driver's license or not, I think that overfloods that and it may not work very well. And I haven't given it a lot of thought. But I think if you physically take something and you give it away and then you are in need of it or your child is in need of it, at least through that next generation, I would be all for the idea that they get moved to the top of the list. I think they've done their part to earn that.
You know,
Sheila, can I just interject? It's Jeff again. That the individual who is a living donor does receive highest priority if they need a kidney transplant. So they go right to the top of the list. That is the practice. Not their child, however.
David is smiling. Very quickly, because we are very tight on time, an email from John who says, I gave my kidney to my sister over a year ago. We are both fine. But then he talks about the expenses. There were lost work days for me and my daughter, who was my companion for the surgery. I also paid for lodging, meals, et cetera. The total cost, including transportation, ran to several thousand dollars. While I could afford this, how many people can? Jeffrey Kahn, is that an ethical concern?
I think that there's an understanding that the costs associated with being a living donor ought to be borne by either the insurer of the person who's receiving the transplant or compensated in the way that was just described. So, no, I don't see that as an ethical issue. That's not receiving something of value in exchange for your good deed. It's just making you whole. You're not having to bear a cost in addition to doing the good deed of being a donor.
Jeffrey Kahn, thank you for being part of this hour. It's been a really interesting conversation. We had a couple of callers I couldn't get to, both of whom wanted to say what a good experience it was to be a donor. David, I thank you for being with us and giving us that message. And Jay Herzog, also, thank you so much.
Thank you for being here.
Also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features sandwiches and salads with specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And I want to thank you for listening and being part of this hour. Tune in tomorrow for an hour on eating disorders, mindfulness, and the brain. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.